Thanks very much, Jack, for inviting me along here today. It's actually a particularly opportune time to do so. Somewhat unusually for a central bank, I'm here to sell a product, which is a report that was put out by the BIS a couple of weeks ago on high-frequency trading, and so being able to speak today basically to that report is useful. Actually got, besides me, two of the other major contributors to that report are in the audience, especially my colleague, who most of you probably know, James Whitelaw, who runs our FX dealing room, but also Jamie Pfeiffer, who's come all the way from New York to listen today, was also another major contributor to that report, so along with a number of other colleagues from around the world. So that's what I'm here to talk about today is high-frequency trading, which is something of the bête noire of financial markets at the moment. So it's been blamed for many adverse developments in recent times, and even including very recent times, but most famously the flash crash in equity markets on the 6th of May last year. But the assessment of high-frequency trading is often hampered by difficulties in identifying it because it is hard to distinguish from other types of automated but not high-frequency trading, generally known as algorithmic or algo trading. So HFT is a part of algo trading, but algo trading has a many times greater presence in the market than HFT. So it's therefore crucial to have a clearer understanding conceptually of what HFT is and is not, and what it does and does not do. So as I said, my speech today is based on a report recently published by the BIS, by the Markets Committee of the BIS. It's available on the BIS website in a, I think, not too hard to find manner. So the report presents the results of a fact-finding exercise conducted by a study group that I chaired, consisting of FX markets from 14 central banks from right around the world, which pretty much covered all the major market centres, both developed and emerging. One of the primary motivations for the report was that much of the attention thus far has been on HFT and equities. There has been relatively little analysis of HFT and FX, despite its large and growing presence in the market. So as a result, we thought it was useful to document some of the facts and issues around HFT and foreign exchange. The exercise in itself was actually, we found, invaluable because beyond the information that we gathered, it helped to strengthen and in some cases establish contacts with a number of the main HFT players in the market. Furthermore, given the different nature, structure and size of the FX market compared to equity markets, it is important to ensure that any conclusions about HFT in equities, as well as any regulatory responses, and the regulatory responses on equity are happening right now, including in the past 24 hours, are not inappropriately generalised to HFT in FX. So that was the motivation for why we wanted to do this, was to basically distinguish HFT and FX from HFT and equity, because I don't think they're the same thing, and that's one of the things we bring out in the report. So how might we actually think about high-frequency trading? So is the very fact that it is too fast for human perception a major cause for concern? That's certainly the question that my colleague at the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, asked, and mostly answered in the affirmative, that being too fast isn't of itself a cause for concern. But let me try and answer that question with analogy to another form of high-frequency technology. So a BMW is a high-frequency trading system, or high-frequency system. There are a large number of electronic messages flying around a BMW at all times, much faster than you, the driver, can possibly comprehend. Note that I say you, the driver, because as FX traders, I assume you drive BMWs. Me, as a humble central banker, I've never driven a BMW. I ride my bike, which is particularly pertinent today because it's ride to work day. But anyhow, I digress there for a minute. So generally, you as the driver of the BMW are unaware of the presence of these high-frequency messages flying around the car. But that doesn't cause you any great concern. Why is that? It's because you are confident about the engineering and you are confident about the monitoring systems within the car. You are confident that this high-frequency system has been appropriately stress-tested and that the systems are resilient to the stress. If, on the other hand, you stick a BMW in a Leyland P76 and let it loose on the autobahn, there would be a high probability it would crash, potentially taking out some of the surrounding cars with it. For those of you, apparently there are some people here who are not from Australia who may not be familiar with a Leyland P76, but it wasn't God's gift to automotive engineering. My British colleague on the report didn't like that analogy, but anyhow, I'm still going with it. So speed per se is not the problem. The issue is the resilience of the high-frequency trading system and the adequacy of the monitoring. So it's useful to think about HFT and FX in terms of those metrics. On resilience, the HFT firm itself has a large incentive to make sure the system being used is resilient. It is typically the firm's own capital at stake. Moreover, there is generally not a lot of leverage involved in HFT. In terms of the adequacy of the monitoring, that is a function of the trading platforms and particularly the prime brokers, and I will return to those issues shortly. So what I intend to do today is summarise some of the main findings of the Markets Committee's report. First, I will describe the topography of the HFT market in foreign exchange and the relationship between the main participants. I'll then discuss the effect of HFT on price discovery and liquidity. I'll briefly examine the behaviour of HFT in two episodes of volatile market conditions, namely the flash crash. So we'll look at what happened in the day of the flash crash in equities, what happened in the FX market during that period, and also the spike in the yen just prior to the G7 intervention in March this year. I'll also highlight the key similarities and differences between HFT in FX and HFT in equities. In all of these issues, we go into a lot more detail in the report. So I said I've got a product to sell today, and I suggest it's worth having a read of that report if you're interested. So finally, I'll conclude with some of the lessons learned so far and highlight some of the issues for further consideration that we raise in the report. So let's start off in just a bit of a recap of the market structure, most of which will be completely familiar to you, but nevertheless, I think it's useful to go there first. So one can think of a topography of the FX market, which starts off at the top with electronic trading and voice trading. So the former, electronic trading, completely dominates the marketplace these days, and the latter is extremely small. Electronic trading can then be divided into manual, where instructions are executed by humans on an electronic trading platform, and automated, where instructions are executed by computer algos and there is little or no human intervention in terms of the execution of the trade. The split between those two, we reckon, is about 50-50. Mind you, that landscape itself is changing at a high frequency. In the FX market, segmenting types of traders is difficult. There is inevitably a lot of crossover in styles and blurring of boundaries. But for the purposes of our study, we split algo trading into two categories, algo execution and algo decision making. So the former is when a trader uses an algo to execute an order, often used for large orders. The latter, which is algo decision making, is where a model is used to initiate a trade based on parameters such as order book imbalance, momentum, correlation, or systematic responses to economic news. It is in the latter camp that we locate HFT. So as you're all probably aware, HFT firms generate their revenues from doing a large number of small-sized, small-profit trades. They operate with low latency and their risk holding period is very short, frequently less than a second. As speed is of the essence, indeed the defining characteristic of HFT, co-location is important, that is, locating the server that sends the order message as close as possible to the servers of the trading venue. However, our discussion with a number of participants in the market suggested that diminishing returns to speed have well and truly set in, such that the value of future games may not be worth the investment cost. Indeed, there was a general sense that HFT was reaching a mature phase, in FX this is, where greater returns were more likely to be had from moving into new market segments rather than spending more time on enhancing speed in foreign exchange. That, of course, assumes that technology is not developed to let one trade faster than the speed of light. And if you have a look in the written version of this speech, there's a reference to an article about what might happen if traders can actually trade faster than the speed of light. I'm sure some of you are capable of that in this room. HFT participants in FX tend to be located in three cities, Chicago, New York, and London, although the physical location of the server is more important than the physical location of the office. Actually, one of the reasons why we had a look at this issue, you may all be aware that the BIS, through the member central banks, does a survey of FX turnover every 3 years. HFT actually makes that, and we do that by each central bank in each of the jurisdictions finding out, asking people in the market what the turnover is. HFT makes that exercise actually quite complicated in terms of working out where the trade is actually taking place. Because in the end, most of the trades, in some sense, are actually taking place, well, nearly all of them are taking place in Chicago, New York, and London on those servers. And the question is, does it matter where the server is, or does it matter where the person or the machine that's executing the trade actually sits? And when we try and look at numbers in terms of turnover in the various centres, some of those questions actually matter, and it's something we're having to think about before we do the next survey of market turnover. But nevertheless, the bulk of trading volume in HFT appears to be accounted for by several large firms, most of whom I'm sure you can probably guess. Most of the activity occurs on the interdealer electronic broking platforms, Reuters and EBS, and the multibank ECNs. The various platforms have differing technologies, trading rules and trading parameters, and that's reasonably important in terms of where HFT actually occurs. There are varying restrictions on quote life and fill ratios. And there is some convergence in some of those, and there's also some divergence in some of those trading parameters. To operate in the market, a relationship with a prime broker is required, and there are a handful of large prime brokers in the FX market, which are generally the large investment banks, not surprisingly. Our conversations with the market indicated that the terms of access varied a reasonable amount across prime brokers. As the prime broker provides the credit to the HFT firm, it needs the capacity to measure and monitor this credit. As HFT firms tend to trade in small size and hold risk only for a very short period, the outstanding credit at any point in time is likely to be small, particularly compared to the other clients of prime brokers. But the high-speed nature of HFT can mean that positions can accumulate rapidly, meaning that the PBs need to have rapid monitoring technology to manage at risk effectively. One reflection of this is the recent development of a kill switch technology to cut off a client's access to multiple markets simultaneously if unacceptable positions are being accumulated. Now, one concern that the Markets Committee report highlights in this regard is whether the prime brokers are adequately pricing the risk in the provision of their services. This risk not only relates to the credit risk, but also the potentially detrimental effect the prime broker, that the HFT firm, the customer of the prime broker, may have on other parts of the bank, of the investment bank's business. Now, one of the interesting conversations we had was we would talk to the prime broker side of an investment bank, and then we'd talk to the trading side of the same investment bank and get quite differing opinions as to the value of HFT participants in the market. And, in fact, it was actually generally a useful conversation to have, was to talk to the trading side and get their opinion of their own prime broking side of the business. So the concern that the trading side often has is that the spread compression or reputational risk of the HFT relation, prime broking relation, as the HFT customer typically is trading on the platforms in the prime broker's own name, not the HFT client's name. That issue, by the way, applies to prime broking generally, the issue of mispricing of the provision of these services, not just to HFT in FX. So how large a presence is HFT in the FX market? Well, it turns out, as I alluded to earlier, this is a very difficult question to answer. Most surveys of FX turnover data do not separately identify HFT activity. As many HFT firms access the market through their prime brokers, the dealer who reports the turnover data will only record the trade as being with the broker rather than with the HFT firm. While Reuters and EBS cannot easily directly identify HFT, an estimate can be obtained by summing volumes of counterparties known to participate in HFT. And Reuters and EBS helpfully provided us with some useful information, or ICAP provided us with some useful information on that. But nevertheless, we can get some sense of the indirect evidence on the increased presence of HFT in the market, in the FX market. So, as I said, the BIS does this survey of FX turnover every 3 years. Between April 2007 and the most recent data, which is April 2010, daily average FX turnover grew by about 20%. So it grew by about 20% over those 3 years. Three quarters of that growth was in spot turnover, and that was nearly all of the growth was in the UK and to a lesser extent in the US. The growth in the UK was principally on the electronic broking platforms. That in the US was mostly on the ECNs. Given the electronic broking platforms are UK-based and the ECNs are mostly US-based, that's consistent with HFT being a significant contributor to the increase in turnover, given the preference of HFT to use those marketplaces. So in the report, we calculate an upper bound estimate for HFT, which is based on the fact that around 45% of trading on EBS and Reuters is automated. And that varies depending on the currency pair, but that roughly around 45%. Given that electronic trading itself is around 50% of spot FX trading, this would imply that HFT could be around 25 to 30% of all FX turnover in the market at the moment in the main currency pairs. Now, that was in 2010. Reasonable guess that that's probably grown since then. So let me turn now to what the effect of HFT has been on the market. So the most obvious impact is that spreads are tighter in normal times, particularly at the top of book. There are questions, however, raised by a number of market participants about the quality of that liquidity, with claims that liquidity has been impaired for larger orders. Moreover, as we note in the report, the quality of a bid or ask is determined by more than just its price. The size of the quote and the longevity of that quote matters too. The effect of spread compression and depth of book, however, is mostly an issue of redistribution of profit around the marketplace, which is why I think it's such a contentious issue. So a number of complaints levelled at HFT firms often reflect the fact that they are taking margin away from the party who's doing the complaining. So one example of this is the accusation of predatory pricing, which is often levelled at HFT firms. So this is sometimes mislabelled front-running. But front-running, at least as I interpret it, implies advanced insider knowledge of a trade. HFT firms don't have that advanced knowledge of the trade as a whole. What they do instead is detect the patterns in trading which are indicative of a large trade coming to market and take advantage of that piece of information. Now, that piece of information is potentially knowable to the market as a whole. It's not insight information, just a reflection of their technology. In doing so, they are taking profit at the expense of another participant. So it's a redistribution of that profit around the marketplace. So so I wouldn't necessarily call it gouging. It's gouging if you're on the wrong side of it, but I'm not sure that that's the appropriate way. I think the best way to view it is primarily as redistribution. That's in terms of normal times. There are, however, concerns that while liquidity is improved in normal times, HFT is causing changes in the ecology of the market, which results in a worsening of liquidity in stress circumstances. One of these changes is that some banks are internalising more transactions, which means that less trades are ultimately seeing the public marketplace. That internalisation is something I think which was happening anyhow. I think HFT has probably accelerated that process. But basically, those who are internalising the trades are using pretty much the same sort of technology to enable them to internalise more trades and manage that risk better. A related issue about the evaporation of liquidity in stress circumstances is that if traditional market makers are pulling back in normal times, as the business becomes less profitable, there may be less liquidity available than in the past in stress circumstances. So to try to get some perspective on that, we looked at the behaviour of the FX market around the time of the flash crash in May 2010 and the sharp movements in the yen earlier in the year. The general sense of the evidence from May last year is that HFP participants were very active in the FX market before, during and after the time of the flash crash. However, while they were present, it is an open question about the quality of the liquidity being provided. That flash crash episode also supports the proposition, particularly in the equity space, that while not necessarily being the initiator of the shock, because at least the general consensus, or I'm not sure consensus is the right word, but the general conclusion at the moment is that the flash crash was originated by a rogue algo, but not a rogue HFT algo. HFT can propagate that shock brought about by that rogue algo rather than necessarily being the initiator. In the case of the yen episode in March this year, there are indications that HFT players certainly withdrew from the market around the time, but the evidence we have is that most other people withdrew from the market as well, including traditional market makers. Now, part of the problem with that episode was it was right at the New York close and in the twilight zone. It's a time when a lot of firms, it turns out nearly every firm actually, shuts down their system and does a date roll. It's also the same time as the Japanese retail get their margins called. So it was basically set up for a problem at that time. But it's not clear that HFT necessarily exacerbated that problem. They certainly stepped back from the market, but so did a lot of the main market makers. Some of the market makers who remained in the market widened their bid-ask spreads dramatically, again, thereby calling into question the quality of the liquidity being provided. Generally standard behaviour in stress circumstances. No participant has the obligation to be a market maker in the market, in the FX market, at all times. You can be still in the market and provide a wide bid ask, but there's no obligation for anyone actually to be a market maker. Turning to the issue of the comparison between HFT and equities and HFT and FX, there are some significant differences between the two. And one important difference, I think, is the nature of the underlying demand in FX versus equity. There is a wider diversity of participants in FX and arguably more underlying demand. I think one of the important distinctions is that ultimately FX is a relative price, whereas equity, to some extent, is an absolute price. So there are always people looking, there are always flows going in both directions in FX. That's not the case in equity. But there are also signs of convergence between the equity market and the FX market, with the FX market becoming much more order-driven rather than quote-driven as it's been traditionally. So having covered some of the facts about HFT and FX, let me summarise the lessons and issues that the report highlights. So on market functioning, HFT has had a marked impact on the functioning of the FX market in ways that can be seen as beneficial in normal times. It helps to distribute liquidity across the decentralised FX market, improving the efficiency and narrowing spreads, at least for smaller trade sizes. But liquidity for larger trade sizes does, may have become inferior. The introduction of HFT or the spread of HFT in the market has affected the ecology of the market in ways that are not yet fully understood. Questions remain about HFT participants' willingness to provide liquidity on a sustained basis under different market conditions. While it generates increased activity and narrower spreads in normal times, it may have reduced the resilience of the system as a whole in stress times by reducing the activity of traditional market participants who have otherwise been an important stabilising presence. That said, as I said, marking on the evidence, recent experience suggests that HFT participants are not necessarily flightier than traditional participants in times of market stress. Furthermore, the market infrastructure itself, such as the various electronic trading platforms, is also changing in reaction to the growth of HFT, and that's likely to have a significant impact on how different market participants execute trades over time. For example, HFT has led to traditional liquidity providers developing proprietary liquidity pools through which to hedge their own risk. Banks are internalising more transactions in-house using the same technology that makes HFT viable. However, that takes liquidity out of the main markets, such as Reuters and EBS. As a result, less information is flowing to the market on trading activity, a development which I think might detract from the price discovery process, at least for some market participants. In terms of HFT and its systemic risks, the May flash crash in equity shows that rather than HFT per se, algo execution more generally can be a trigger of systemic risk. And rather than being an initiator of such shocks, I think HFT is more likely to be the accelerant on such shocks and propagate shocks initiated in one market to other markets. It is important to bear in mind that while HFT is dependent on technology to function and that trade positions are often being closed, open and closed faster than human comprehension, there still remains an important human element. HFT models are continually monitored by human traders to ensure they're performing as expected. In turbulent times, it is generally the human trader who turns the machine off, not the machine itself. In terms of market integrity and competition, many of the predatory or unfair practices attributed to HFT in light of their technology-driven ability to detect orders and take advantage of latencies are in fact not new. I mean, one of the issues I think we came across is that HFT is just a different manifestation of issues that have been in the market in one form or another for most of the past few decades. In terms of regulation, HFT in FX is subject to three levels of self-regulation. In addition to HFT firms' own risk controls, there is also the monitoring by the prime brokers. As I said earlier, one significant concern we document is whether the prime brokers are technologically capable of keeping up with their HFT clients or whether they have the financial incentives to do so. Furthermore, the trading platforms have rules to foster an orderly and fair trading environment, but the nature and severity of such rules varies, in fact, quite considerably across those trading platforms. The Foreign Exchange Committees in a number of jurisdictions are currently considering implementing enhanced codes of conduct, which aim to address the market integrity issues raised by the increased presence of HFT. As Jack mentioned earlier, ACI—that's always been a major part of ACI's agenda in terms of codes of trading conduct—and again, that's an issue that they are looking at as well. So, finally, an interesting question to ask, but not addressed in the report, is whether HFT is a socially efficient use of resources. This is a question that a number of people raised with us during the course of the report. So, I think one way one can ask this question—I mean, one. Can ask this question of a number of fields which adopt cutting-edge technology, whose immediate social benefit is not apparent, at least to me, such as Formula One racing or America's Cup, both examples of using cutting-edge technology. As I said, the social benefits of those two sports, being neither a petrolhead or a sailor, not always immediately apparent, but they have led to technological improvements that have benefited society as a whole. Now, I'm not saying that HFT is going to come up with this cutting-edge technology which is going to benefit society as a whole, but anyhow, I think it's interesting to at least pose the question that way. So it's not quite, but maybe another way to ask the question is to instead ask whether HFT is actually harmful. There are plenty of things that we do in life which are not obviously socially beneficial. The more relevant a question, I think, is to ask whether they are socially harmful. So one of the purposes of the report that I've been speaking to today has been to provide a set of facts with which one can try and to answer that question. So to some extent, we try not to be too judgmental about all of this and just lay out what the facts, at least as we saw them, and allow people to try and have a somewhat more informed discussion of that question. So to conclude, HFT and FX is a rapidly evolving phenomenon, not surprising given its high frequency. It's having a notable effect on the structure and functioning of the FX market. It's causing behavioural changes in other market participants that may have an impact on the resilience of the system as a whole. So while it may be the case that the impact on market functioning is generally benign, it does require ongoing monitoring to ensure that this remains the case. The monitoring currently is done predominantly by the prime brokers and the trading platforms. There is a concern that the monitoring by the prime brokers may be inadequate if the risk inherent in the services they are providing is not being appropriately priced. We as policymakers are trying to keep abreast of the impact of HFT on the FX market by maintaining contact with the different and evolving market participants. In some cases, as I said a minute ago, this is happening through the involvement of policymakers in the foreign exchange committees in the various jurisdictions and the major trading centres. Industry bodies such as the ACI also have an important role to play through their work on market codes of conduct. So let me finish there. As I said, this is all gone into in a lot more detail in the BIS report, but I'm happy to take questions on the topic that anyone might have.
Well, Guy, my name's Guy as well. I'd just like to ask you how the behavioural changes were caused by the participation of HFT traders in the market. I mean, that I find that unbelievable.
Well, I mean, one issue we had, so a lot of the major traditional liquidity providers, when they were concerned about their ability to execute large orders or they were seeing their spreads being compressed. I mean, I think it was a development which was happening anyhow. So this is the internalisation of more trades within an organisation. That development uses the same was happening anyhow, using the same technology or similar technology to HFT firms. But it provided an extra incentive to have more of those deals matched internally rather than put them out to the market, because they were able to, you know, basically generate more income that way than executing the deal in the market.
How do you determine these behavioural changes were caused by HFT? Traditionally markets crash for one reason, and that's because you run out of buyers. No. And in the past, in 1987, the crash was blamed on computers. And then about 6 months later, everyone woke up, that's nonsense, that people program computers and the markets crash because you run out of buyers, whether it's generated by a computer or a human. And this time we've come to HFT and we've got a committee that's got up and told us that it's run out of buyers because of HFT. And they're actually the ones providing the liquidity you need to keep buyers in there. Let me finish. When the recent crash, they stopped, the Americans stopped shorting because they thought this was what caused the crash. But I'm telling you, the reason the crash occurs, you run out of buyers. And what all they did by taking the shorters out, how do the shorters take their profit? The first thing they do to take a profit is they're the first buyers back into the market. So they abolished, in their wisdom, they abolished shorting, and the market continued to crash further. And I can't see how any committee, yours or any other, can draw a conclusion that because there's HFT traders in the market, they're actually reducing their capacity to trade large volumes. It's just complete nonsense to me.
That's actually not the conclusion we drew. In fact, I thought we actually pretty much drew the opposite conclusion, so maybe I didn't present it as well. I mean, as I said, we basically tried to be neutral and say, look, this is having... The market structure is evolving. We made the point that actually HFT firms' behaviour was no different than that of other firms in the market. So I don't... So at least the way I interpreted what I just said then was that I wouldn't attribute any of this to the behaviour of HFT firms. What I'm saying is that their behaviour was not discernibly different from anyone else in the market. So they're just another market participant with similar-ish reactions to stress times. As you said, the primary issue is an evaporation of buyers on one side of the market. So I'm saying that one of the points we make in the report is, by and large, their behaviour is no different from anyone else in the market. They are a market participant and they behave in similar ways. So I would not say that the conclusion we drew, at least in this committee's report, was what you said. We're saying these guys are having an effect on the way that other participants in the market want to participate in the marketplace. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily for better or for worse. I'm just saying it's affecting behaviour. As I said, what we're trying to do is just say these are some of the evolutions which are going on in the market. We're not drawing any normative conclusions from that. It's just trying to give people a chance, to provide some evidence for people to make their own assessment on.
Do you think we need to be aware of imposing values on HFT that maybe other participants don't have to adhere to, through regulation?
As I said, it comes back to the same question. They are a participant in the market like a whole bunch of other people. I mean, one issue I think which is interesting is that of market making. So there's general assumption that there are people out there who are market makers. There's no obligation on anyone to be a market maker in the FX market. And, supposed market makers can turn off their machines or widen the bid-ask spread whenever they feel like doing it in stress circumstances, just as HFT participants can choose to participate or not in stress market circumstances. So the one issue which I think is interesting is really the issue of codes of conduct in the FX market now, the FX market has basically always been self-regulated and still continues to be self-regulated. And by and large, I think that's been quite effective. Now, one of the issues that was brought up with us by a number of market participants is whether everyone is playing by that same code of conduct or whether all the platforms are basically applying that same code of conduct. Now, that's an issue for the market. That's not an issue which we as regulators are imposing on the market. That's something which is being regulated by the market. But it's an interesting... So just as HFT participants shouldn't be scapegoated for particular issues, I mean, it seems to me that it cuts both ways, that if you're a participant in the market, you should buy it by the rules of the marketplace, which is set by, in the FX world at least, not true in other markets, but in the FX world, is actually set by the market itself.
G'day, Guy. Scotty Nielsen from NAB. It seems to me that more than the high-frequency traders having an impact, it's the internalisation of a lot of the larger banks. Their percentages are getting up toward 90% of internalisation. When we see periods of stress and high stress, these larger banks, they start tipping, and that's when we see an acceleration of and the evaporation of liquidity. The high-frequency traders can't keep up with it. They're pitching in ones and twos. How do you see that impacting on us over the next 12 months?
I mean, I'm not sure about the next 12 months. I think it's actually more an issue of the next 5 years. So I think one issue is that... And this is the way that the marketplace is changing, which is a function of the technology, not of the high-frequency trading, which is if you have, particularly if you've already done the spend on the technology and you're at the cutting edge, if you're not at the cutting edge, it's hard to get to the cutting edge of the marketplace. And seems to me there's, and this is very evident in the data, there's a much greater concentration of the business in the major players in the market. And to some extent, that's a function of the technology. And if you're in the middle tier, I think your life is potentially going to get difficult because to invest in that technology spend, it's not entirely clear that the returns are actually going to be there. It may be useful in terms of particular market segments, like if you want to be a liquidity provider in the Aussie, but whether you're going to, your ability to compete in the major crosses may be difficult if you're a sort of mid-tier organisation. So one thing which has been apparent over a number of years now is an increased concentration by the large firms who have done that investment, who are able to, to stay at the cutting edge doesn't require as much of a spend as it does for an organisation which hasn't had those systems in place before. So there does seem to me there's a bit more of a bifurcation in the market, which is, I think, going to be an issue over the next 5 years or so.
Do you think that's going to make us more equity-like as a market?
I don't know, actually. So that's a question we ask, but another question we ask, but we don't answer. So it's still not. I mean, it does seem to be evolving that way to some extent, but it still seems to me that the nature of the underlying, as I said, the nature of the underlying flows in FX are different from those in equity, which still seems to me that it's not going to be an order driven. I just don't see it becoming a completely order driven market.
It strikes me that a lot of the underlying flows you're talking about come at certain times of the day, particularly during London hours. So do you think you could actually get sort of different market behaviours at different times of the day as a pattern?
Yeah, I mean, we've always known the liquidity in the market varies over the course of the day. I'm not sure that it actually, I mean, to some extent, as other FX markets becoming more liquid at other times outside the London trading day, you're actually starting to see a bit more of a spread of liquidity across the day. I mean, one thing which was interesting, which came out of the Japanese experience, is I don't think everyone realised that, you know, for instance, when people were doing the roll dates, they happened to all turn off the machines at pretty much the same time. Now, one thing my Japanese colleagues are looking at is staggering that process so that you don't have everyone turning off their machines at exactly the same time. You don't have everyone making their margin calls at exactly the same time, you know, 1 minute after the New York close, which most, you know, rest of the time wasn't a problem, but when the market's thin can be a problem. So, you know, some of the characteristics of the market probably will change, and I think generally in a way actually which will make the market more rather than less stable.
Hi, Jeff Rogo at Dow Jones. In the in the U.S., as high frequency trading grew, we saw exchanges create these sort of new initiatives, like the New York Stock Exchange with naked access or direct edge with flash trading, and we saw these these innovations, which we might call a bit of a sticky wicket here, but in Australia or in the United States, we just called them illegal eventually and got rid of them. Was there stuff like that in foreign exchange as you went through your review that you saw and said, all right, this is an innovation, it seems smart, it's increasing whether it's liquidity or volume, but if you think about the cause and effect here, there's some stuff that get brought up that maybe we need to take a closer look at, whether it's on ECN or the brokers in London.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. As I said, a lot of this, the platforms themselves are adjusting their trading rules. There's a constant dialogue between the platforms and the market participants in particular. And as I said, there's quite a large variation in rules across the different platforms. That's one thing which became pretty apparent. And part of that reflects the nature of whether, you know, the platforms themselves are offering up different sorts of services. And I think there's some delineation in terms of the services they're offering. Some platforms are saying we are a stable environment where you can be confident of not getting picked off. We have a way of enforcing appropriate trading behaviour by, you know, adjusting bid-ask spread client by client if we start to see behaviour that we don't like. So, you know, if you're playing by the rules of the game of our trading platform. And to some extent, there's competition across the platforms on those sort of dimensions, some offering a service to one sort of client and some offering services to another sort of client. And to some extent, I think the market's going to sort that one out. You're seeing people migrate their business to platforms where they're confident that they can execute well and away from platforms where they're not confident that they can execute well. So, that, you know, this, as I said, in the FX market, the self-regulatory nature of the market has generally been, I think, by and large, fairly stabilising. And this is one example where that's actually happening, as, you know, you're seeing the business migrate, or certain participants are comfortable dealing on certain types of platforms, not comfortable on dealing on other types of platforms.
Did the subject of dark pools come up at all during your investigation in FX?
Yes, it did. There are people who are thinking about such issues. The internalisation, it seems to me internalisation is, So one thing I think which is interesting is that a lot of these things are just different names for phenomena which have been in the market for 30 years. I mean, there's always been problems in executing large orders. There was always different ways of telling when a large order was coming to market. It was a question of who made the money from that. Now, it seems to me that who's making the money from that is changing as the market's evolving. But that's always been an issue. You know, internalisation to some extent is creating your own dark pool where you have some potentially proprietary knowledge advantage. So a lot of these are just different names for phenomena which have been around in the market for a long period of time. The internalisation one is interesting. As you said, that's the sense we get. I'm not sure if it's 90%, but it's a number which is getting close to that in a number of cases, which is interesting. The net of all that still hits the market, but in terms of the gross flows that the market's seeing, that's not as large as it necessarily might be. It might have been in the future. Again, to some extent, that's a redistribution issue. The client may be perfectly comfortable with that in the sense that they're getting an appropriate price. Other participants in the market may not be getting as much of that margin as they would have in the past. That it's as much an issue of distribution of those returns around the market as it is of anything else. But it does, if you think that there is information content in the flows, if more of the flows are being internalised, there's less of that information coming to market, which may not be a good thing.
The term dark pools really refers to regulated markets, not Forex,
yeah,
which are over-the-counter products.
No.
Regulated markets, if the contract exchanges and it's not listed in that regulated market, it must be in a dark pool.
Yeah.
The term internalised means where the bank transfers between customers, or the prime broker between customers. In my opinion, the whole Forex market is a black pool in that it's not in a regulated market.
I think what Colin was sort of referring to was a few people getting together. I mean, as you said, I mean, we've got a whole bunch of, the FX market is a whole bunch of exchanges out there with different varying sets of market participants. I mean, there are possibly some initiatives where a small subset of those participants are looking to form effectively a marketplace with restricted access. ICAP allows you to access their marketplace, provided you meet certain criteria, but effectively that access is open to everyone. Some of these other marketplaces, if they come about, may have a somewhat more restrictive access.
Paul Higgins from Optiva. We are not active in that in the FX business. I'm going to be later on the panel. You mentioned dark pools internalization and large orders and block orders. I'm just wondering, what is a large order? Because if you say that 90% of the volume can be internalized, does it mean that 90% of the orders are large orders?
No, the 90% number probably applies to only a few firms. So there are a lot of the other participants in the market won't be internalising anywhere near that number. But in the past, if you had a large order, you would spread it out over some number of days potentially and try and execute the best possible way. Now there are algos which allow you to execute a large order in a shorter period of time. Some firms can sit on the other side and reverse engineer those algos and see that coming to market. So, the distinction I was making is if you want to do a $1 or $2 million trade, you can just execute that without any trouble at all. If you want to do some multiple of that, then you want to try and break it up. It seems to be the best way to execute that at the moment is to try and break it up into a whole lot of $1 or $2 million trades and execute that across a large number of platforms. It was more just, the standard, this issue that if you're executing a small trade, the market's not going to move. If you're executing anything much bigger than that small trade, then the pricing is probably going to start to move against you.
Given the changes in the market you're talking about, has it changed the way the central bank intervenes in the market? Can you be effective?
I can't speak for ourselves. We haven't done it for a little while. But you have to ask maybe my Swiss or Japanese colleagues who have a little more recent experience than I do. That's a question we're answering. We're asking. We haven't answered it yet. We certainly, and most other central bank colleagues, use electronic execution. So that's obviously changed from where it was, certainly some number of years ago. So, the way we execute in the market obviously has to change. I'm not sure, you know, I have to wait to if and when we intervene again to find out whether we need to change our tactics. As I said, that's a question probably best answered by my Japanese or Swiss colleagues who have much more recent experience. But nevertheless, I think at least in both those two instances, you know, they certainly had an impact on the market, which I don't think was discernibly different from that in other, you know, in times gone by. I better call it quits after that.
Sorry, Guy.
Hear the words of wisdom from the panel.
One of my colleagues from ICAP, Brad Howe, asked me to ask you on the as obviously with all the regulation coming through on the swaps markets and the interest rate markets becoming more electronic now. Do you think the high frequency trading is going to start moving into this zone?
And you see it moving into this zone. I mean, I think that, I mean, I think
part of the survey, you know, there was that did that come up quite a bit? Or
I mean, I think the general sense we got is that where there's liquidity, then this, you know, this strategy works. Where there's consistent liquidity, let me put it that way, this is a strategy which works. I mean, so, you know, to some, you know, HFT most, you know, sort of broadly originated in equity and then moved into FX, and it's moving into other market segments. It's in, you know, in fixed income where there's, you know, constant, you know, a minimum amount of liquidity throughout the trading day, and there's not that many fixed income markets where you could say that, then this strategy works. So, you know, it basically comes down to the consistency of liquidity. If you can be confident about, so, I mean, this issue came up even when we're talking about the prevalence of HFT in some of the emerging currencies. So some of them it works, some of them it doesn't, because you can't be confident about the consistency of liquidity. So you don't want to be, you know, halfway, you know, which, I mean, I know we're talking milliseconds here, but you don't want to be halfway through a trade and suddenly discover that the market's just, you know, evaporated or something else has hit the market, which has just moved the market completely against it. So you want to be confident about the consistency of liquidity. But if that work, if that's there, then it seems to me that that's the market where the HFT can move to.
The only other question was literally the credit prime for the fixed income market, because obviously that's very, very different than it.
Yeah. But that seems to me that's mostly a systems issue for the prime brokers. I mean, one interesting issue on the prime broking side was that was really a question. I mean, there's an interesting issue in latency when it comes to prime broking. So if you think that, you know, there are different latencies across the different platforms. So if you execute, and the difference in messaging time as well. So if you execute on one platform and you do the other leg of the trade on another platform, but there's a difference in messaging time back to the prime broker, the prime broker can think you've actually got a large open position, but you've actually already offset it somewhere else. So there's an issue of how, you know, how high frequency the prime broking system is and how good the communications are and the varying communication speeds. So, I mean, one issue we were trying to get our heads around, which we didn't, I don't think, come up with an answer, is, you know, how large a position can you actually accumulate before anyone really picks it up? And then, you know, it comes to the issue of the kill switch technology. You don't necessarily want a kill switch technology which shut someone down just before a whole bunch of messages are going to come in, which says actually they've just closed out that position on another exchange. It's sort of, you know, it's an interesting, you know, ultimately almost technological question.